Well, it's been lovely to give this little series of talks. I was thinking, it's the Millerepa mini-series, isn't it? I've really enjoyed it. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it tremendously. And it's lovely to have a Millerepa shrine this evening. Very, very beautiful. So some people are here who haven't been to the previous talks. So I did avoid saying last week, previously on Millerepa. I'm a great great TV watcher, as you may gather. Anyway, previously on Millerepa, we've been exploring the life of Millerepa. We've done quite a lot of exploring the life and encouraging those who've been here to kind of try and get inside Millerepa's life, as it were, and make connections with the episodes in his life, with things in your own life. And I really love the life of Millerepa. I hope that's come across. I think it's just such a great, dramatic, vivid, human story. And Millerepa, of course, starts off with a lot of difficulty, and he manages to turn that around. So that, I'm sure, speaks to a lot of us. So I also wondered if, given what we were talking about last week, we were talking about one of Millerepa's dreams, where he dreams about his family home, and his home's in ruins, and his mother's dead, and his sister's wandered, and it's a very poignant, tragic story. And it's such a strong dream for him that he has to go and check it out. So I wondered if anyone here had a dream after that talk. I had a dream. I think I said last week that I had a long association with the house I grew up in, from when I was born to just a few years ago when my mum died in that very house. So I often dream of that house, and the night after I gave the talk, I dreamt I was in the house I grew up in. I was an adult, so my mother wasn't there. I was as I am now. Sometimes I'm younger, sometimes I'm a child, it depends. But she wasn't there. I was with a friend in the house, and somebody knocks on the door. So I open the door, and there's a young woman at the door in her 20s, early 30s. And I understand that she's looking for her mother. She's adopted, and she doesn't know how to find her mother. She says, "Do I know?" And she gives me a name, and I don't recognise the name. She shows me a photograph, like a little cameo, and I don't recognise the person. But that's what I understand, is that she's searching for her birth mother, and she knows it must be in that area somewhere. So I grew up in a very small street, and she's going door to door trying to find out something about her mother. And she didn't have a very nice time with the neighbours. She'd rung on their doorbell first. Not the normal neighbours that I used to know, dream neighbours, because they were a bit kind of condescending about the fact that she was adopted and was trying to find her mother. And I just felt so kind of strongly, I so wished I could help her find her mother. I had a very strong feeling in the dream. So I did wake up, my pillow wasn't wet with tears, but I was very moved. So that was my dream. I don't know what yours was. So this week we're going to explore Millerepa taking hardships onto the path and transforming hardship into joy. So Millerepa is a great exemplar of this whole practice of taking difficulties, hardships onto the path. And it's a central Buddhist teaching. It's not just a teaching of Millerepa's lineage. It's a central Buddhist teaching because it's involved with concern with the perfection of patience, with kshanti. So the Buddha in the Dhammapada, we go back that far, says forbearance or patience or kshanti or kanti is the greatest asceticism. Hatred is the greatest evil. Forbearance is the greatest austerity or the greatest practice. And I suppose what he means by that is you don't have to go out of your way to practice asceticisms or austerity. So we know that he practiced very strong asceticism, and we know that in India at that time and in other parts of the world, in ancient Egypt, people would do things like, you know, stand with one hand in the air for 10 years, or stand on a pole on one leg, or, you know, strange things like this. So he's saying, well, you don't have to do those kind of things to practice patience. Ordinary everyday life gives us plenty of opportunities for developing patience, whether that's with inanimate objects, the material world, the weather, whether it's oneself, one's body, aging, sickness, death, and perhaps most difficult of all, with other people. And that reminds me of a scenario many years ago in my life where I was sharing a house with my good friend Parami. We were living in one of the communities in Approach Road. And she was in the bath, and I was trying to wash my hair in the sink. So this is very typical of me. The taps were running, my head's under the tap, and I'm trying to trying to find the shampoo and get the top off the shampoo because I didn't prepare properly. And I'm, you know, a little irritated that I can't get this organised. So this is quite me. And Parami's like in the bathroom watching this, and she says, the thing about you, Dharmadina, is you're pretty impatient with inanimate objects, a bit more, you know, a bit less impatient with yourself, and you're quite patient with other people. No, it's not bad, is it? I still struggle with the shampoo tops. Yeah, so there's plenty of opportunities in everyday life for us to practice patience or kshanti. And the perfection of patience, of course, is developed as a teaching in Mahayana Buddhism, particularly by Shantideva and also by Atisha. So Bhante, when he talks about the perfection of patience, when he talks about the word kshanti, he says it's not just forbearance or endurance. It's not patience just in that sense. It's a very beautiful word with a lot of connotations. So he says it also involves love, compassion, spiritual receptivity, tolerance, acceptance, gentleness, empathy, sympathy. And so it's a very rich emotion, a very rich state of mind. And I think it's pretty obvious that it's a crucial thing for us to do, particularly if we're aspiring trainee bodhisattvas, because it is the opposite of hatred, revenge, retaliation, all those negative mental states which we have come across in Minarepa's life in quite a strong form. So if we have some aspiration to help other beings, to get irritated with them doesn't kind of help us in that aspiration. Of course we do get irritated, but it doesn't really help, does it? So we need to kind of work with that. And it doesn't really help it if we get irritated with ourselves, what happens in our own inner mental states. So developing kshanti, patience, is a way of continually dissolving the barriers between us and other people. So it helps us transcend that self-other dichotomy, as it were. I think the other reason why patience is important to develop is spiritual life is not necessarily easy, is it? Maybe it is for you. Certainly hasn't been that easy for me. So it's not necessarily easy. And even if things are going well, even if your practice is going well, we don't know, do we, what's going to come our way. We don't know what's going to change in the conditions we find ourselves in, what's going to happen to us or our family or the world we live in. We don't know what's going to happen. So it's good to develop patience in order to meet whatever happens. And the essence of this approach of taking difficulties onto the path, which is explored very much in Shantideva and explored in what's called the mind trainings, particularly of Atisha, is that nothing is an obstacle, nothing is a difficulty, nothing is a hindrance. So everything is then an opportunity for practice or awakening. Everything that comes your way gives you an opportunity to practice for awakening. So that's quite practical, because difficulties and hardships are going to happen. And we can't necessarily always change conditions as they arise, but we can work with our response to those conditions. So it's quite practical. I also think it's quite liberating, because it's very inclusive, isn't it? It works against that kind of if-only tendency, doesn't it? If only I had better health, I could meditate more. If only it was quiet, I could meditate. You know, there's always an if-only, isn't there, that would enable us to meditate more effectively or practice more effectively. So it's very practical and it's very liberating, because it's inclusive. So everything, there's nothing that is outside the path, as well. Everything is part of our experience. Everything is there to kind of help us along the way, as it were. And I think Minarepa is a great exemplar of this kind of practice. So his practice of patience begins really with endurance, doesn't it? He endures the trials and tribulations that Marpa asks of him. He says, I reduced my body to powder in his service of his relationship with Marpa. And we explored that last week. So I was thinking, just this is a bit of an aside and a bit of a going back, and I think it's very interesting, this whole thing about building, because Marpa set him this task, doesn't he, to build the towers and take them down and build them again and take them down. And through that he was purified of a lot of his negative karma. He also learnt strength, patience, endurance, faith in his teacher. But he also built something and took it down, built it and took it down. So he learned something quite, there, didn't he, about impermanence. He could see that happening. He could see impermanence happening. It's interesting. So that's building houses, and then he has this dream about his own house, you know, his strong personal dream about the ruined house, which when we explored it last week, we said, yes, it was a very personal dream, but the ruined house is also a metaphor for samsara. So, again, it's a building falling into ruin, expressing impermanence. And then later on in the chapter where he first meets Rachungpa, his disciple, he comes across some people building a house, and he asks for alms. And they say, well, you look like you've got plenty of time on your hands, and why don't you help us build the house? They're not going to feed him unless he works for them. And he says, I finish my house in my own way. So he says, faith is the firm foundation of my house. Diligence forms the high walls. Meditation makes the huge bricks, and wisdom is the great cornerstone. With these four things, I built my house, which will last as long as truth eternal. So it's a very sort of creative expression of the spiritual life, you know, using building metaphors. So I think that's something that's quite interesting about he has to endure the tasks under Marpa, but eventually, you know, he's building in a very different kind of way. He's building his spiritual self. I also think it's quite interesting Bhante's aphorism when he says, work is the tantric guru. Work is the tantric guru. You don't need a Marpa, you just get a job. So something external to you, which, you know, you can work with, you can reflect yourself back from, you can see how you're doing, you see how you're developing, you can see how your patience is developing, is very important. But anyway, first of all, Milarepa's practice of patience is a practice of endurance and forbearance with the tasks he was set. In terms of his patience with others, I think one of the most interesting expressions of that is his patience with his aunt. So his aunt was, his aunt and uncle were so awful to him. They, you know, they beat him. They took away his inheritance. Very, very cruel to him. And when he re-meets her, she is very abusive and physically abusive to him. And then she's scheming. She wants the house and field. It's still there. She wants to own it. So she sort of schemes. Milarepa by this time is meditating in a cave, practicing the Dharma. So yeah, she's very scheming, and she comes to see him, and she wants him to give up. She wants to know that he's not going to practice sorcery anymore. She's still a bit sort of frightened of him. And he says, well, I could still practice sorcery, but I will not do so. On whom should I practice my patience if not on those who've wronged me? Patience is said to be the shortest path to enlightenment, to Buddhahood. And you, aunt, are the very person on whom I should practice patience. Moreover, you and my uncle are the means of bringing me to a life of renunciation, and I am sincerely grateful to both of you. And in return, I will pray for you and that you obtain Buddhahood in a future life. And he gives her the house and field. So it's very strong, isn't it, that kind of ability to be... to express kshanti to her and really mean it, and also to be grateful to her for putting him on the path of renunciation. It's very much like Shantideva in the Bodhicharavatara, isn't it? In the chapter on kshanti, where, and also Atisha in the mind training, where they both encourage us to see our greatest enemy as our greatest benefactor and be grateful to them for giving us an opportunity to practice patience. Now, this is not saying this is in any way easy. It's not easy at all, is it? But I think it's crucial to sort of begin practicing in that way if we're going to change hatred into compassion, if we're going to live in the love mode, and if we are going to give up revenge, retaliation, blame, and all those unskillful mental states. So it's not easy, but he does that with one of the people who's treated him the most unkindly. So then he goes off into solitary retreat in remote caves, and in the life and in the songs, this occurs over a number of years, and he goes to a remote cave and he says, I vow not to go down to the village for alms, clothing, pleasure or medicine. So we might think, well, he's in the high mountains, it's cold, but he's fine because he does this psychic heat practice, doesn't he? The Tummo practice, the psychic heat practice, which he learned from Marpa. But actually in the beginning, he's not very good at it. He hasn't yet managed to do it. And he says, because of lack of food and weakness, I found it hard to develop TUMO, and I was still very, very sensitive to the cold. So that gives a sort of sense of someone in process, doesn't it, developing and perfecting a practice. So he prays to Marpa, and he has a dream, and in the dream he learns some exercises which help him develop TUMO. So obviously the practice of TUMO, this practice of psychic heat whereby you generate heat in your body, obviously does sustain him in the cold mountains with very little to wear. After about a year, he thinks, oh, I'll go out for a little bit of recreation. And he says, oh, no, I made this vow. I mustn't do that. I must eke out my supplies. And he ekes out his supplies for another 3 years until there's nothing left. And then he thinks, well, I could just wander outside the cave and see what's out there. And this is where he finds the nettles. So the rest, as they say, is history. he finds nettles. And he says, joyfully I stayed there. I had no clothes on the outside of my body, no real nourishment on the inside. I was greenish in hue and had greenish hair, but I was happy to be where I was. So not only do you have this kind of ability to work with difficulties, objective difficulties and hardship, you also have this beginning of that sort of happiness and joy and spontaneity, which is so much part of Milarepa. So then there are a number of incidents where he's up in these remote caves where hunters come by. So it's a pretty inhospitable place, I imagine, Tibet not being there, but it's very mountainous, so it's probably hard to grow things and people hunt, and you get the impression there's not a lot of grub around in Tibet, so you know, there isn't a sort of Tesco Metro down around the corner. So hunters come, and they're hungry, and so they're always looking for food. They see him in a cave, and they think, well, he must have something to eat. So one lot of hunters are not very nice to him. They kind of throw him around a bit, looking for food. They kind of abuse him physically. And again, he says, I had no feeling of retaliation. In fact, I felt really sorry for them, and I shed tears for them that they behaved in such a way. So, you know, again, you see this kind of ability to respond to difficult circumstances from other people, which is often the most difficult, isn't it, with this kind of love. So some of these incidents are quite funny. When he's telling his life, you know, there's a sort of humorous aspect to them. So again, you get this kind of lightness. So some more hunters come, and he does manage to give them some nettle soup to eat, because that's what he eats. And they say, you know, it needs a bit more seasoning. Have we got any salt? And he says, I'll just put some more nettles in. Could you, you know, have we got any flour so we can make it thicker? I'll just put some more nettles in. yes, have you got any salt? Yes, put more nettles in. So it's kind of nettle soup, isn't it? And, you know, it's quite sort of amusing, isn't it? The other one, which I really like, and you probably know this story, is someone comes searching the cave at night. And it's obviously pitch black, and Milarepa laughs and says, well, if you can find anything here by night, you can have it, because I can't find anything here by day. So he has this lovely sort of sense of humour. And, you know, he gets into conversation with these hunters, and some of them say to him, well, you're the most pitiable wretch I've ever come across. I mean, look at you, the most pitiable wretch in the whole world. And he says, no, I'm one of the most fortunate and best among those who've obtained the precious human birth. Everything is comfortable for me. So a very high level of patience, endurance, forbearance, backed up by this kind of positivity. Yeah, because he's so devoted to his practice. So we talked last week about him being found by his sister, Pita, who hasn't seen him for many, many years. So she's kind of overjoyed to find him. And then when she sees him, she's really shocked. I mean, people, when they see him, they say, oh, are you a human or are you a Buddha? A Buddha is a kind of ghost because he's so strange looking. You know, he's ragged and no clothes and green and and so on. So she really wants him to be a successful Dharma teacher. And she's really unhappy the way he is. And he says to her, yes, my food and my lodging and my body don't look good. I'm like a madman in my behaviour. But if you could observe my mind, it is the Bodhi mind itself. So that's what he's interested in. He's interested in what's happening in his mind. So Peter and his former betrothed, Zeze, they bring him quite nourishing food. So he's lived on this kind of nettles for a very long time. So they bring him more nourishing food, and it has quite an interesting effect on him. It has an unsettling effect on him. I suppose it's like if you've been fasting or you've been on a diet or something, and you eat something rich, if you've been eating very simple food, it kind of upsets you. So it upsets his whole system. He's very involved in very sensitive meditations on his chakras and his inner channels and his inner energies, and it kind of disturbs all that, so he can't meditate. And that really disturbs him, because his path is the path of meditation. So it's at this point that he opens the scroll that Marpa left for him. If ever he was in extreme difficulties, he'd given him this scroll. And whatever's in there, practices, he does. And he has a big breakthrough. It's as though there's kind of turbulence, and then there's a breakthrough. So he has quite strong realizations at this point, including he develops siddhis, so he can fly, he can walk on water, and transform his body. I'm not going to go into all that, but if you read the songs of Milarepa and you read the life, he has this ability from his practice. And he's very, very grateful to Peter and Zese for kind of enabling him to kind of move into a whole new dimension of experience, of realization. So then he decides, he's seen flying about, and he thinks he's called attention to himself. So he decides to move to an even more remote cave. And on his way, as he's moving, he drops his pot. He's got this clay pot that he cooks his nettle soup, and he drops it and it breaks. And it says that there's a kind of inner crust of nettles, so it kind of rolls out complete, a pot-shaped nettle inner thingy. So yes, it breaks, and he says, "Oh, even the earthen pot, by having existing and now not existing, shows the component nature of all things. It also symbolizes human life. So I, Milarepa, the devotee, resolved to persevere unwaveringly. The earthen pot, which was my sole wealth, by breaking has become my guru. For it preached to me a wondrous sermon on impermanence." So it's as though this idea of obstacles aren't obstacles, what happens to you, how you respond is obviously important, but anything can become your guru, anything can teach you the teaching of impermanence. It's very quite Zen-like, isn't it? The old Zen masters, it would be just a leaf falling or something, and that would be it, they kind of wake up. And I think this, the fact of him being able to see the pot as his guru is quite a yardstick or a hallmark of the fact that his practice of endurance, of patience, has gone really quite deep. It's quite similar to the other story, isn't it, where he's got his the wind, and he's trying to gather sticks, and he falls over and he drops the sticks, and then his robe blows away and his robe's up the tree, and it all goes terribly wrong, and he kind of is blown over, and but he does have quite a deep insight into the nature of ego grasping, because he realises he's unhappy about losing his wood and his robe, because he still has an ego that still grasps. So he has an insight. This is an earlier story. It's quite similar. In this case, the sticks and the wind and the robe would be his gurus. So I think we can just see Milarepa moving from endurance, forbearance, in some of these instances, to him giving birth to what we can call the yogi's joy, which he expresses, doesn't he, in that song, the yogi's joy. So then it's a joy not dependent on circumstances. It arises from his realization of Mahamudra, from the clear light of the void, from the nature of mind. It's a very deep experience. So then it's not that you're happy despite the circumstance. You're not sort of gritting your teeth and enduring. You know, we have to do that sometimes, don't we? But here it's as though everything is a reminder of the Dharma. Everything becomes a reminder of the Dharma. All reminders of impermanence. So all suffering becomes joy. And he says in one of his songs, "To make a task of life became a joke to me." So you get this sense of this kind of spontaneous upwelling joy. And in the Song of the Yogi's Joy, he says, "Joyous exceedingly where hardship is great. I was joyous exceedingly where hardship was great." I think in one translation it says, the harder it was, the more joyous he was. "And I was joyous that suffering had turned to joy." So it's as though, there's no more suffering. He's transformed it into joy. And I think perhaps one of the examples of Milarepa's practice of forbearance and his expression of joy, one of the strongest ones is in the Song of the Snow Ranges. So he goes to Lashy Mountain, and he's got lots of patrons at this point, so they take him up to this very remote cave in the snow mountain, and they leave. They leave him with provisions, and they leave, and as they leave on their way back to their village, it snows, and it says it snowed for 18 days and nights. And in the song he sings later, he describes, the snow, and he just says, it snowed beyond measure. It's just an incredible amount of snow. So everybody was cut off. He was completely cut off. And in this great disaster, I remained in utter solitude. And he describes it as a battle between his practice of developing Tummo, which he's obviously still developing, and the snow. And he wins. So he manages to develop enough psychic heat to sustain him in that kind of circumstance. So meanwhile, back in, and he's cut off for 6 months. They can't get back to him for 6 months. So when the spring comes, they think he's dead, his patrons, and they have a sacrificial feast for him. But then they think, well, we better go and look for him. So they make it up to the mountain, and on their way up, they see this beautiful snow leopard, which disappears. And then later they come to the cave, and there's Milarepa, and he's saying, he's taken a while to get here. And they say, well, how do you know I was coming? Well, he was the snow leopard. And he says, come on, I've got food ready for you. So he's been snowed in for 6 months, and yet he's offering them some food. And they say, well, how did you survive 6 months cut off in the snow? And he says, well, most of the time I was in a state of deep samadhi. I didn't need any food. On feast days, the Dakinis fed me. Occasionally I took a little dry flour on the end of a spoon, and I had visions that you offered me much food and I felt no hunger. So you have a sense of the kind of depth and extent of his practice. And he says, I, the yogi, am very well indeed. And how are you? Are you all well and healthy? So again, you get this wonderful sort of lightness and sense of humour. And they're all overjoyed that he's alive, and they all dance and sing, and Milarepa joins in and dances and sings. And so they have a great time, they have a party. So yes, we can see Milarepa moving from a practice of forbearance and endurance to becoming, in a way, one with reality. To see life, however objectively difficult, as a cause for joy and happiness. So everything is a joy to him. And he's obviously supported in this by his practice of Tummo, his meditation practice, and also by his practice of Mahamudra. But I think it relates back to something we might be aware of in Mahayana Buddhism, in the life of the Bodhisattva. So the life of the Bodhisattva is said, isn't it, in some texts, to be a play, a lila, a lalita. It's not a struggle. Yes, you have to make effort. Yes, you need the perfection of virya. But at some point, or even at every point, it can have a lightness about it. Your practice can have a lightness about it. It can be a play, a lalita. So it can be a sort of spontaneous upwelling of energy, of bliss. And in later Mahayana, this was called the Anubhogacharya. So charya means way. So you've got the Brahmacharya, the Dharmacharya, and you've got the Anubhogacharya. Anubhoga means spontaneity. So it's the way of spontaneity. The Bodhisattva's life is the way of spontaneity. And that might seem, interesting, isn't it? Because the Bodhisattva is bound to save all sentient beings, in three millenniums or something. So it can appear like a bit of a hard graft. And obviously, it demands, as I've said, it demands energy, it demands virya. But at the same time, there's this emphasis on play, on enjoyment. And in Tantric Buddhism, this is more usually referred to as sahaja. So this innate, spontaneous, completely natural upwelling of energy. Like a spontaneous bubbling up of a fountain, or like a flower unfolding. So this, I think, is a quality to look for in our own spiritual lives. So Milarepa says, I'm happy whatever appearances show their face. Whatever happens, I rejoice in. Because the world shines divinely, I am happy in whatever I do. I think it's not surprising that one of the names Milarepa was given, this is a name given to him at one of his initiations by Marpa, and apparently the name was given to him by Marpa and the Dakinis, is Laughing Vajra, Hasa Vajra. He's the Laughing Vajra. So he's got the sort of Vajra element, the kind of determination, the persistence, the perseverance, the energy, the virya, and at the same time he's got this ability to laugh, to enjoy himself. So what does all this mean for us? It may seem way, 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 way beyond us. It's a long way from struggling with a shampoo top and trying to develop patience. I'm making some progress with that kind of thing. I'm still not great with inanimate objects. I think it's good to learn to develop patience at any level. And Shanti Deva says, nothing remains difficult if practiced. So through practice with minor discomforts, even major discomforts become bearable. I'm sure that's, if you look at your own life and experience, you find that to be so. So probably when you first learned to meditate, you know, your leg fell asleep after 5 minutes and it was unbearable, unless you were a yogi. And now, well, you may still fall asleep, but somehow it's not so unbearable. Or you manage better, don't you? So lots of things that used to kind of irritate you or upset you when you first started to practice probably don't anymore. So nothing remains difficult if practiced. I suppose that's the principle, isn't it? That if we can learn to practice forbearance or patience, we'll get stronger. And in the chapter on patience in the Bodhicharya, Shantideva encourages us to practice. He says, first of all, on the irritation of bugs, gnats, mosquitoes, hunger and thirst, and then cold, wind and rain, so that's a bit more familiar to us, journeying and sickness. And if we don't practice forbearance, endurance, patience with those things, our distress will only get greater because we'll be so sensitive, we'll be irritated by the slightest thing. So there are going to be difficulties in our life, in our spiritual life, both inner and outer. And if we can see what arises as opportunities for practice, things that kind of wake us up or show us where we need to pay attention, then that's very positive. And I think it is very liberating because it does mean that everything is included on the path. So in the mind training teachings, in Atisha's 7-point mind training, which definitely focuses on taking difficulties onto the path, one of the yardsticks or measurements that you're beginning to do that well is that you always have the support of a joyful mind. So it's never that you're kind of, you know, just gritting your teeth and enduring. You know, there's always this kind of encouragement or emphasis on developing joy at the same time. So it is how we relate to what's happening, isn't it, that's important. And I think it's Pema Chodron who says that supports for this attitude of always having the support of a joyful mind can be quite simple. There could be things like a sense of humour. So, you know, something's difficult, but you try and sort of look at it from a slightly humorous point of view. You have curiosity, you pay attention, you take an interest. So small things can be very effective. And sometimes I think, I don't know about you, but if you're having a really, really hard time, of course, if it's overwhelming, if it's on top of you, then this is very hard to do, isn't it? To have the support of a joyful mind and to see it as something you can take on the path. Then I think you need your spiritual friends. You need as much support from the outside as possible, as it were. But with lesser things, sometimes you can be having a really hard time. Things can be quite difficult. And yet you have a sense of satisfaction that you're practicing. You know, you have the Dharma that you can put into practice, and somehow that gives those difficulties or places them in a very different perspective. I'm sure you've had that experience, certainly my experience. So then you have a sort of sense of gratitude, don't you, to the fact that you found the Dharma, you're leading a spiritual life, and you know, those things which are so difficult, yeah, you hold them in a different, more compassionate, more metaphor, more sympathetic context. So joy is very, very important in our spiritual lives. Minarepa exemplifies a very, very high degree of unconditioned joy that arises out of his understanding, his realization of the nature of mind. But for us, on our own level, we can still cultivate joy, cultivate enjoyment. And joy, of course, is one of the links on our spiral path, isn't it? You have dukkha, you reflect on dukkha, and hopefully that gives rise to faith. Naturally, out of faith arises joy. So then joy is satisfaction, delight, contentment, that you have a clear mind, you've got nothing to reproach yourself from an ethical point of view. So your mind's not disturbed, so then you can move on to the next stages of concentration. And if you have a clear mind, you feel in harmony, you feel integrated, and so on. So Bhante says about this state of mind, you can be happy, open, carefree, with a song on your lips. So let's all have a song on our lips. If you're unhappy, if your mind is troubled, then there are practices you can do. You can meditate, you can confess, you can do confession practices, you can work with those hindrances to get back. You can go back to sources of faith, which are often your friends, so that you kind of work back up again to that sense of joy. And I think we can look for enjoyment moment by moment, in the same way we can look, or in moment by moment, whatever hardships arise, we can try and have a positive attitude towards them, not see them as obstacles, try and see them as teachers. At the same time, in the same moment, as it were, I think we can look for what I call the enjoyment factor. You know, whatever's happening, it's possible to find enjoyment. It might be really, really tiny. It could be that you just manage to sort of look out the window and there's a blue sky or the sun shining. Or it could be something really, really small in a moment of your life, which is quite difficult. But something about that, you know, even though it's very, very small, this enjoyment factor in what you're doing, if you focus on that, then that will grow. That moment or that mental state will grow. And it's just a doorway into a wider perspective. So I think at every level and every moment, we can learn to try and see obstacles as opportunities. At the same time, looking for joy, looking for happiness, looking for the enjoyment factor in whatever way we can. It doesn't often take very much. But Minarepa was supported in his practice of this kind of unconditioned joy by his practice of Mahamudra, which I'd like to just explore a little bit before I finish. So Minarepa was taught and practiced and taught himself a complete path, a path of regular steps. When he comes out of his first stint in solitary, his first 11 months, and Marpa asks him to tell him his realizations, Minarepa runs through, as it were, his practice of and realizations in a graded path, going right back to fundamental Buddhist teachings. The teaching on Nidanas, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, going for refuge. He's familiar with the Bodhisattva path, the precepts, the perfections, and so on. And also with the Tantric path. So he's on a path of regular steps. But in his lineage, which we talked about his lineage last week, the culmination of practices in that path is Mahamudra, the direct looking at the mind. So this is what he practices sort of later, as it were. And Mahamudra means great seal or symbol. So Maha is shunyata, is voidness. So it's the mind sealed with voidness. The mind is sealed with emptiness. Because Mahamudra is not a thing. Mahamudra is the nature of existence. Mahamudra is the nature of mind. And mind is, as it were, sealed with emptiness. So sometimes mind in Mahamudra is called the clear light realization of the void. The nature of mind is blissful and void. It's the bliss light void. It has all those sort of qualities. And this kind of teaching in his lineage goes all the way back to the 84 Mahasiddhas, through to Lopa, Naropa, to Marpa. So in this lineage, Mahamudra is the nature of mind, and mind is described or pointed to in various ways. And you're probably familiar with these terms, but mind is said to be open. So this is one of the qualities of mind, the nature of mind. It's open, it's empty, it's like space. It has no limits, no boundaries, no peripheries. It's not describable in any way as a thing. It's not an object. It has no shape or colour or size. And if you know Minarepa, and you know the story of the shepherd's search for mind, the shepherd's got a young boy who comes to Minarepa. Minarepa sends him off and says, well, you've got a mind. You go and find out what it's like. Where is it? What it's like? Has it got a colour? Has it got a shape? Does it live inside or outside your body? Where is it? And the shepherd boy comes back and says various things about the nature of mind, which includes that the mind is open, it's empty, it's spacious. It's like the clear blue sky, it's like empty space. Sometimes it's said to be like the ocean. So mind is empty, open. But it's not just empty or open in a dead sense. I mean, the sky, space, is inanimate, isn't it? So the mind is not like that. So the mind is imbued with what's called clarity. But the clarity is luminosity. It's the luminosity of awareness. So that spaciousness, that complete open space of mind, is completely imbued with knowing, with awareness, with a capital A. So space is illuminated. There isn't one source of light. The nature of mind is just that it is illuminated with knowing. The mind is aware. And the third quality of mind is said to be it's unimpeded. Sometimes people talk about clarity, openness, clarity, sensitivity. That's the third character, but often it's also termed unimpeded. The mind is unimpeded, so it's completely open. It's like empty space. It's like the clear blue sky. It's permeated by the light of awareness, and within it everything arises. Everything manifests in mind. This is very much Milarepa's tradition, very much his school. So nothing is eternal. All things arise in the mind. All things are the manifestation of mind. And there's a very positive take on those manifestations, even though they're thought forms, and they're thought forms of all kinds, you know, skillful, unskillful. In his tradition, it's said that everything that manifests in the mind is the radiance of the mind. So it's a very, very positive view of mind. So using the metaphor of the ocean for the nature of mind, the mind is open, it's like the ocean. The luminosity of the awareness is like the sun shining on the ocean, and this endless manifestation of thought forms in the mind and of the mind are like the waves on the water. The thing about waves on the water is they're not different, are they? The waves are water, the ocean is water. It's not a different thing. So the sort of kind of practice that Milarepa would have done, his meditation practice, when he's looking at directly at the nature of mind, would be not to try and suppress thought, not to try and suppress any of those manifestations of mind, because thought forms are not the enemy. The enemy, if there is one, is lack of awareness. So what happens with us, I think, is when we get distracted by our, you know, endlessly chattering, busy minds, is we get caught up on the content, don't we? We go with the content. Sometimes it's good to explore the content of one's hindrances, but to do that with awareness. I'm talking when you just kind of go, and 10 minutes down the track, you've forgotten, you know, what it was you set out to do, which was count your breath about 10 minutes ago. So we go with the content of our thoughts. And this practice, looking directly at the mind, you need unwavering mindfulness, you need unwavering awareness and total presence, and then within that, you realise that although on the surface this endless kind of manifestations of thoughts, they all look different, which is why they're so interesting, why we get caught up with them. If you go a bit deeper, they're all the same. They all arise in dependence on conditions. And anything that arises in dependence on conditions lacks any substance or inherent existence and is therefore empty. So thought itself, all these manifestations are empty. They're empty, but they appear. They appear, but they're empty. So they're not a problem. So the method is to, and those of you who've done bare awareness, pure awareness, I'm not quite sure what it's called these days, but any kind of just sitting where you're not doing a bhavana practice, the method is to relax. To relax and let your mind settle, as it were. So relaxation is the key instruction in Milarepa's lineage. Relax and let your mind settle. It's effortless, it's natural. So Tilopa says, this is one of his instructions for meditation, let your body be like a mountain, unshakable. Let your breath, voice and energy be unhindered and free-flowing. And let your mind be open and radiant like the sky. So be loose and relaxed. Let your mind settle. Be at natural ease. And you can see this in Milarepa's posture, can't you? He looks very relaxed in his posture. So the kind of characteristics of this kind of nature of mind, this kind of practice, is straightforwardness, naturalness, genuineness, authenticity, simplicity, spontaneity, openness and clarity. So it's very inspiring to think that one could live in that state, as it were. And one of the effects of being able to live in that state is to be able to see the world afresh every moment, every minute. If you can sit relaxed and just allow the thought forms to manifest and you don't follow the content, if you have enough presence to see the empty nature of thought, and you see that thought is void, then there's a gap between one thought and the next. You kind of break the chain, is the way you break the chain of karma. So that enables you to see the world differently. So with us, when we're caught up in our habit patterns, so thoughts are blown, as it were, by the winds of karma, aren't they? we get caught up, don't we, in repetition and familiarity, and it's the same old, isn't it? And we get bored and so on and so forth because we're just caught up in habit. But in this state of mind, everything looks new every minute. There's a kind of vividness, a freshness to life, to experience, inside and outside of meditation. Sort of childlike innocence and playfulness. So this is very much the quality of the great Mahasiddhas. They're very, very playful. They have a sense of wonder at the world. Don't take anything for granted. Everything is a new experience. So it sounds, to me, I mean, I find this very inspiring. It sounds great, and I'd like to be like that. But according to the teachers in this lineage, it's not that easy to live from that state of mind. And a little saying that says there are four errors, four things that stop us living from the nature of mind, from Mahamudra, which are quite interesting. It's too close to recognise, so we overlook it. So it's our mind, you know. So it's so close we can't see it, and it's overlaid by our habit patterns. It's too deep and profound to grasp, so we can't get at it. So yes, it is simple, it is spontaneous, it is genuine, it is authentic, but actually it's not that easy for us to let go of all our habit patterns and just relax into that state. It's too amazing to understand intellectually. It's completely beyond thought forms. And it's too easy and simple to be believed. So, you know, there's little obstacles in our way from living in that state of mind. And Dilgo Khyentse, in one of his books, who was a Dzogchen practitioner, very similar to Mahamudra, says, without the preliminaries or the foundation practices, the main practice of meditation will not resist deluded thoughts. And carried away by circumstances, the mind will be unstable. So for most of us, we just need a lot of path of regular steps, bhavana practice, and then we can intersperse that with, you know, sessions of pure awareness where we can sort of relax and let go and see what happens. But otherwise, if we just, we may be very gifted, but otherwise we may just be doing so-called bare awareness, and actually we're, this is my experience sometimes anyway, I'm just kind of drifting and dreaming. I haven't got that unwavering mindfulness or presence at that point. So I think the best person to talk about Mahamudra is not me, but Minarepa. So I'm just going to read some songs of Minarepa. Many of the songs he's expressing Mahamudra. So this is from the Challenge to the Logicians, if you want a reference. So this is Minarepa singing about Mahamudra. So you get the sense or the flavour. When I practice Mahamudra, I rest myself at the intrinsic state, relaxing without distraction or effort. In the realm of voidness, I rest in illumination. In the realm of blissfulness, I rest in awareness. In the realm of no thought, I rest with a naked mind. In manifestations and activities, I rest myself in samadhi. And another song. I, the yogi Minarepa, see the essence by gazing nakedly upon it. I see beyond concepts, clear as the sky. By letting go, I see reality. By resting at my ease, I realize the voidness of all and everything. I relax, and come to the self realm. I let go, and in the flow of awareness, the pure and the impure become one. Third song. The essence of mind is like the sky. Sometimes it's shadowed by the clouds of thought flow. Then the winds of the guru's inner teaching blow away the drifting clouds. Yet the thought flow itself is illumination. The experience is as natural as sunlight and moonlight. It is beyond both space and time. It is beyond all words and description. But assurance grows in one's heart like many stars shining. Wherever it so shines, great ecstasy arises. So Minarepa sings from this open, natural, spontaneous, bliss-void, compassionate, non-dual emptiness. That's his realization and his experience. And in one of his songs he says, the little songs spring from my mouth. They are the natural outflow of my heart, which is very beautiful. So that's where he's coming from. Particularly once he's realised enlightenment, but most of us, I think, probably not there yet. But we can contemplate Minarepa's life and take inspiration from his devotion to constant meditation practice. He is determined, he was determined, he persevered. He was willing to embrace hardship for the sake of the Dharma. He was willing to see every situation as his guru until there was no difference for him between hardship and joy. So I think we can start that practice now, and every moment we can see if there's something, you know, a little difficulty, we can try and develop a little bit more forbearance or patience with. That shampoo top is going to be, I'm going to be patient with it next time I wash my and at the same time, you know, you can look for the enjoyment factor moment by moment in your experience. Even if things are tough, even if the objective circumstances are tough, there's going to be something, unless things are very, very, very tough, there's something in your life, in your experience, that you can find some enjoyment and some beauty. And I think it is crucial, and that would be a doorway to placing whatever hardship within a greater, kinder perspective. So I'm going to conclude with Milarepa's last teaching, Dukkhampopa, which most of you will be familiar with. It's the following on from the song that was read before the meditation. So this is both Milarepa expressing his ability to endure hardship, his sense of humour, and his joy. So Gampopa is leaving for good. And Milarepa says to Gampopa, "I have an unusually profound pith instruction, but it's too precious to give away, so off you go." So when Gampopa had crossed the river and reached a distance where he could barely hear the jetsam's voice, Milarepa called him back saying, "Well, who else but you would deserve to receive this most precious pith instruction, even though it is of too great a value to be given away? Now come here and I will impart it to you." And Gampopa says, "Oh, I know, do I have to get a mandala offering together? Should I do something?" And Milarepa says, No. "I hope that you will cherish this teaching and never waste it. Now look." And saying this, Milarepa lifted up his robe and exposed his naked buttocks, covered with lumps of callus. So he says to Gampopa, "There's no greater teaching than this. See what hardship I have undergone. The most profound teaching in Buddhism is to practice. It has been simply due to this persistent effort that I have earned the merits and accomplishment. You should also exert yourself perseveringly in meditation. And this unforgettable sight," very bony bottom, I imagine, "this unforgettable sight made an indelible impression on Gampopa."